You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2001 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Colin Edwards on the subject, Painted Pictures in the Mind.
Everyone. Thank you. Now, I'm going to move around this morning because I now know that this is a free-roving mic and I'm not connected to one on the desk, which I'm much happier moving around because working in schools and in classrooms, teachers never stand still. It's part of their roving eye contact with everyone. This morning, we're going to be talking about two characters. We're going to be talking about the man at the pool of Bethesda, and we're going to talk about the man who was born blind. So first of all, I'd like you to turn to the Gospel of John and chapter 5. And as we did yesterday, I want to open the class by just reading the first few verses and then spending a little time explaining what the scene would have been like so that our imagination is fired. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem, by the sheep market pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. Now let's stop for a moment and let's think about Jerusalem at the time of Christ. Now, the drawing there is by kind permission of Leon Rittmeyer, but the Leon Rittmeyer in the United Kingdom is a very well-known archaeologist in Israel, and he and his wife do a lot of publications and literature on the Herodian Jerusalem, and they're in fact well recognised as experts in their field. It's quite interesting that in the truth we have brothers and sisters who have international recognition for their work. And this is a couple who come into that category. Now, this is a drawing based upon the research from archaeology, and yes, it's drawn up as what might have been the scene. Let's take it up a fraction further. You will be familiar with the Kidron Valley running down here. You'll also be familiar with the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom, which comes up this side. There is a third valley which goes up there, which at the time of Jesus was a very distinctive valley called the Valley of the Cheesemakers, or the Tyropean Valley. So there are three valleys. And above the valleys, the heights are literally up there. If you stand right down at the bottom, at the Rogel, right at the bottom, with the village of Silvan behind you, you look up to Jerusalem. It's quite steep. And at the time of Jesus, the area here, which is the old city of David, which is in fact Zion, was somewhat in decline. It wasn't as significant as it had been. In fact, today, that process has gone on almost completely, and it's a totally despised and rejected area of the city. And if you want to find the Pool of Siloam, for example, which is right down the lower part of that, you'll have great difficulty, because it's Arab-held piece of land, and it's not a very nice area to travel in. But that's another subject. Now, at the time of Jesus, the Temple Mount dominated the whole of the city. And probably, and I say probably because we don't have any direct evidence, by the Fort of Antonia, which is there, which was the garrison fort for the Roman soldiers in the city, just to the north of that, strictly outside the city walls, were an area of pools. Now, there are very large pools, which many tour guides will say, ah, that's the Pool of Bethesda. Reasonable archaeologists say, probably not. The Pool of Bethesda, which is described in this record, was probably a smaller pool right up here, right on the edge right up in that area there. Now, if that is correct, then it's adjacent to the Great North Road, and the farmers and the householders driving their sheep or their goats for sacrifice would bring them down the North Road to Jerusalem from Galilee and from all the northern areas. And it would be the proper and right place for a sheep fold and a place where the sheep could be washed before sacrifice. That is at the opposite end from the place where the pilgrims entered, which was here. There's a great staircase, and the remnants of that staircase even today, and the two doorways under the great royal stoa here, and the pilgrims would go in this way. At the back side, and I mean that in its strict sense, at the back side of the temple would be the sheep gate. And immediately you're into the area. It's the despised area. It's the place where the impotent, it's the place where the diseased, the outcasts of society, those who were banished from the temple, those who were banished from the city, that's where they lived, right out in the back of beyond. You see, we are quite used to having handicapped people in our society. And we're all familiar with that. But in many parts of the world, that is not the case. If you are handicapped, you are despised and rejected. You're a throwaway. And you're a throwaway to die. Now, I put it to you that the identification of this pool near the sheep gate is telling us that it's the place which was despised. The place at the backside of the city. The place beyond. And it would also make sense that if Jesus came from Bethany, which is over here, and came in a Sabbath day's journey, that would be about the maximum that he could walk and not anything over this side. It would seem that here there are a series of springs, and the springs fed the pools. It was not, I would suspect, a beautiful porticoed pool. I don't think for one minute it was like that. In my imagination, I'd always thought that this pool at Bethesda was like the Roman baths in Bath in England. This sort of size with beautiful columns and porticoes and a balcony. Something like of the scale of this room. And a nice clean pool in the centre. And they sat around gently on the side and waited. Nothing of that at all. I think it was filthy, dirty. It stunk. It was a mess. The place where the sheep were brought. And if any of you have ever dipped sheep, you know precisely what I mean. It's not a nice place. It's the place of where the despised and the rejected live. Now you've got the picture. Let's just for a moment just extend that while we've got the overhead on and we're just talking about Jerusalem at the time of Christ. Let me just, we should come back to this later in the week. But that's the magnificence, let's put it square, that's the magnificence of the extrapolation of the findings of the Ritmeyers to produce the Herodian temple. Or to be precise, the temple that Herod built. It was the house of the Lord. It's a mistake when we say Solomon's temple and Herod's temple, because they were not. Jesus says this was the house of the Lord. You've made it a den of robbers. So you can see now that the pilgrims would enter up through that stairway under the royal stoa, which is this area here, and probably the Sanhedrin met at that end. They walked underneath here out into the court of the women. And this magnificent temple was all ahead of them. Right at the far end, right out of sight, was the pool of Bethesda. Let's now progress to the record. I'm going to have to move my Bible around to get my focal lengths right. I'm sorry about this. So the problem with glasses is that you're so dependent on them. And if they're not quite right, everything's in a haze, and it's not really right. That's better. Okay. Now, just a little point in passing. I said yesterday, and one or two people picked me up on it, that the Gospel of John was probably the first Gospel to be written. Now that is totally against received opinion. Now one of the points of evidence that I would suggest that John wrote his Gospel earlier than is usually assumed is there are one or two references, and there is one in this chapter, in the present tense. When John wrote his Gospel, the temple in Jerusalem was still extant. It was still there. Because he said, and we read it through, I don't know whether you noticed, now there is in Jerusalem. Present tense. It's not, now there was in Jerusalem. It is. Just a little hint of the precision of John's Gospel. That he was writing this when the temple and the pool and so on were all still in existence. If you go 67 or even the years immediately prior to that, when the Romans, there was a degree of aggro between the Jews and the Romans, and definitely from AD 67 onwards, it could not be said that there is, because it was not. It had been removed and destroyed. So that's just a point in passing. Now, there was a certain man. He's not named. It's always interesting in Scripture when a person is not named. It's almost as if they're a representative person. They're a real person. Of course they are. This was a real man. He'd been there 38 years. But the fact that he was a certain man implies that he's a representative man. And the use of that term, precisely 38 years, should to everyone in the room ring bells immediately. A certain man, a literal man, but a man representative. Israel, yeah. They who for 38 years wandered in ignorance, or at least not in true understanding and knowledge. Just a little hint that we have here an acted parable. Just a little hint. And so, Jesus comes and finds this man. When Jesus saw him lie, verse 6, and knew that he'd been there a long time in that case, he said to him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" What a strange question. What a strange thing to ask. Of course he wanted to be made whole. He was desperate to be made whole. It is interesting that the word that's used for whole is not just the word to be healed, it's this word to be sound. It's actually the word therapeuion, from which, of course, we get therapy and therapeutic and all the other related terms. And it's the whole process. He wanted to be made, Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be made fit and well and sound and clear in mind and spirit?" All of that's really understood by this word therapeuion. It's more than just to be healed. So although the question on the surface sounds to be a strange question to be asked, Jesus, when he would have asked it, is meaning rather more of this man. Now it's interesting, the impotent man doesn't answer that question straight away. His mind is still on this practice, this process that they understood that an angel went down at a certain time and troubled the pool. Now we don't know what that refers to. They thought that it was an angel. It's not a piece of divine teaching saying that's what happened. It may have been a link to the washing of the animals at sacrifice, and it may well have been that when they sluiced down the temple courts, and that the water full of blood and gore and so on washed into the pool, that they may well have felt that this would heal, and people moved their friends and relatives into the pool to be healed. I know not. The way that John describes it, he's referring to a piece of tradition, as it were. He doesn't say that's what had happened. He said that's what was thought to have happened. And this man alludes to this. He says, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool, but while I'm coming, another steppeth down before me. And again, he doesn't say, another man steppeth down before me and is healed. All he says is that another gets there before me. And so then Jesus says to him, rise, take up your bed and walk. And immediately the man was made whole. Not just healed, but made whole. Took up his bed and walked. And the same day was the Sabbath. And then out of that arises a whole body of dispute and disagreement about the Sabbath. And so, as we said yesterday, the character and the situation of the man gives rise to a body of teaching. And that's how John's Gospel is constructed. Although it does have a structure, a very clear structure, the incidents that are recorded as introductions to teaching. Now, very often, we settle on the study, on the theology, and miss the incident. And that's not the way we should be tackling it. As yesterday, when we were talking about Nicodemus, and about being born of water and of spirit, it arose out of a situation. Now that we're talking about the man who is here, it arises out of a situation. And it would seem to me that the man being there for 38 years and a discussion about the Sabbath are intimately linked. The one is linked to the other. As if this was a symbol of Israel, who in ignorance and in unbelief felt far more about the Sabbath law and about the ritual associated with it than the making of men whole and them being healed and restored and given life and power and thought. See the implicit contrast that John in his Gospel is drawing between this character who was despised. And John adds then a little postscript in verse 10. He says, the Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it is the Sabbath day, it is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. He answered them, he that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk. Then asked they him, what man is that which said unto thee, take up thy bed and walk? And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. Several things here. The record of this little conversation between this man and the Jewish authorities suggests very clearly that the man did not believe. He did not know. And so it is apparent then that Jesus finds him. It's the Sabbath day. It's not lawful. You can't carry. The fact of him being healed and made whole is just totally ignored. Just a little aside. Sometimes we are preoccupied by legality and not by the hearts of men. Sometimes we illustrate and demonstrate more the attitude of the Pharisee than of the Master. Sometimes we are preoccupied with our history and our traditions and not with saving men and women from death. Jesus finds him where? In the temple. Now, why is that significant? Well, you have to remember and go back to the times of David, that when David wanted to have a capital city, you remember there was the Jebusite fort sitting above these valleys, and he wanted it as his capital city. And Joab went up through the gutter and conquered it, the old Jebusite fort, and it became the city of David, the city of Zion. Now, it was said at that time that the blind and the lame could protect that city. It was so impregnable that it didn't need an army to keep it safe. So when David conquered it by the means of Joab, he actually put a principle there that the lame and the blind will not enter into Jerusalem, into the temple, and when it was constructed, into the temple itself. So the notion and the comment that Jesus found him in the temple again speaks volumes. Because the man had been healed. He'd been made whole. He could go to the place from where he'd been barred. He had had no access to worship God in the temple area. He was out, despised and rejected, out in this pool where all the muck and the filth was. But now Jesus found him in the temple and Jesus makes himself known to him. And the man then is restored totally. Let's follow it through. Verse 14. Afterward, Jesus finds him in the temple and said unto him, "Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon thee." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. And then, almost immediately, although there is a paragraph marker, Jesus then launches into a doctrinal statement about his authority and about his origin. It would seem to me, although there's no evidence for it, that probably that which follows was before a subcommittee or whatever of the Sanhedrin. It may well be, and we need to just go back to our location of the temple, and when I can see my stick, I can put it on there. Which I can't, because it's rolled on the floor and disappeared. All right, okay, thank you. Now, if the pool of Bethesda was up there, and now this man has come through and into the area around here, Jesus finds him in this area, it may well be that Jesus walking back out and would come down through... come down through these doorways, that he would pass through the outer area of this what's called Royal Stoa, which was where the Sanhedrin met. At least in this area, it was the debating chamber, the chamber where the Jewish scholars met and sat, as it were, and talked and debated. Dare I say, the same place where Jesus, aged 12, had met the leaders of the Sanhedrin and the scribes and so on. Now, as the teacher, par excellence, was here, probably in that area, its juxtaposition to the temple area makes sense. Because that which follows in the rest of this chapter is a theological presentation about his status. And it arose out of his challenge of the Sabbath law. It arose out of his challenge to the Jewish leaders. It arose out of the question of whose authority Jesus actually worked under. And so we have in the rest of John 5 the relationship between the Son and the Father. Verse 19. Then answered Jesus and said unto them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he seeth the Father do. For whatsoever things he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. For the Father loveth the Son, and showeth him all things that himself doeth, and he will show him greater works than these, that ye may marvel." And so he goes on in like vein. It's arisen out of this context of the healing of the impotent man. It seems to me to arise directly out of the acted parable that this man represented Jewry, who did not believe and did not accept the power of the God of heaven. And it's arisen out of the conflict over the Sabbath day. So the theology arises out of a situation. It arises in a real place with real people. And so when we read later on in chapter 5 about the great power and the day, marvel not at this, the day is coming when even the dead shall hear. What he's saying is that this man who has been healed and restored and now able to walk in the temple and praise God is just a symbol, he's just a representative sample of the power and the authority that I'm able to show, which is not mine, but him that sends me. And he will do greater things than these. He will even raise the dead. And I can feel that, the tension in the air. I can feel the hostility growing. I can feel the challenge of Jesus to the Jewish authorities. And it seems to arise out of this situation. Let's move on. Let's move on to the man born blind. John chapter 9. Now, it's probably some time on, I'm not going into the chronology this week, but probably some time further on. But it's in the same place, or at least in the same city. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man that was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, "Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but the works of God should be made manifest in him. I must work the works of him that sent me, while it is today. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which is by interpretation sent. He went his way therefore, and washed, and came seeing. That speaks volumes. Let us just for a moment think about the implications. Let's think about the implications of the disciples' comment. It's very easy for us to think that somebody who is ill because they've done something wrong. It's very easy. We don't think we think like that, but it's quite easy to do so. But Jesus' argument is absolutely clear. It's so logical. He's born blind. Now, the people thought, well, if he's born blind, well, his parents must have done something wrong. No. Now, it's so that the glory of God could be seen. I think sometimes our attitude to those in need is sometimes a little awry. Let me explain. We've talked, and several of us have talked about, when you're working with those who are in need, the easiest thing is to get out your wallet and give some money. That's easy, but it's wrong. Sometimes money is needed, but that's the wrong way to do it anyway. All that you're saying is, "I've got money, you haven't, here you are. I come from a society who's got plenty of money, throw it, give it away," so on. You're not respecting somebody else at all. What's far more difficult is to get alongside and spend time. In our society, money doesn't really have much value. It enables us to do things, but it doesn't cost us anything. But time does. Time is valuable. Now, if we're ever going to get to grips with care, we have to give time. And you have to give time and be alongside someone. And then when they give you something out of their poverty, they give you, and then it hurts you, and that's when it's right. If it makes you feel good, it's probably not right. That may sound Irish, or it may sound back to front or inside out or whatever. What's the equivalent of being Irish? You know, in England, if anything's a little different.
Be careful, there are Irish here.
Sorry, I think I'll dig a hole for myself. My children say, "Dad, you're just digging a hole." So I'll change subjects. Right. I'm just thinking for a few moments about need.
No,
I'm not going to talk about anything like that. Let's talk about need. It's only when we're alongside people and we begin to see things from their point of view, not from ours. You see, you go to somebody who hasn't got anything in their little fridge, which is rusting and falls open when you open the door. Our immediate reaction is, oh, well, we need to go with them to the grocery store and buy them some food. And no. What we need to understand is how it's like to live in those conditions, just to get our mind round that. See things from their point of view. See, I was saying to somebody yesterday, we have a sister in Estonia who, other than my time to sit alongside and have a cup of coffee and a slice of her cheesecake, that's really good. Come another slice, please. And she's thrilled. She's thrilled because I'm respecting and giving acceptance to what she can do. Now, that's understanding just a little of someone else's need. She's a hostess. She grew up the daughter of the Russian ambassador in Britain in the 1950s. She's a lady. But through Soviet times, her life has just gone down like that. So 10 years ago, age 55, she worked in a meat packing factory, handling slabs of meat and cutting it up and packing it, and her hands were raw to the bone, literally. And she showed me the scars on her hand. Now, you know, that's come from one society to another. And in a way, she doesn't have much in the way of material goods. But I have to recognise that and give time. So all of that's a little aside about understanding need. When Jesus met this man who had been born blind, he was more concerned about declaring the glory of God than he was about where the blindness had come from and its background. He accepted the fact of the man's blindness. It was just a fact of life. The man was born blind. End of story. Let's be a little less emotional about it, a little more factual and straight. He'd been born blind. Right, okay. Born blind so that the glory of God can be manifested. And neither this man nor his parents have sinned. Then what happens, right? He gets hold of the dust and spits into it. Couldn't do that. Oh dear, that's a bit unhygienic. Can't have one cup because we might pass a few germs from one person to the other. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But see what I mean? We wouldn't dream of taking some dust from the ground and spitting into it. But that's what he did. And he then plastered it over the man's eyes. So he reinforced his blindness so that he couldn't see. He couldn't even see the light and shade. It was total blackness. And then, let's have a look at the map again. Anywhere in this area of the city, or even here, Siloam is down there. And it's a steep slope down there, believe you me. No matter where he is in the city, he'd got a difficult journey to make to the pool of Siloam. How'd he get there? I don't know. He would have had to have been led by the hand. But his blindness was being reinforced. He was aware fully that he was blind. And when you get to the pool of Siloam, you've got 40-odd steps to walk down. And there's no rail at the side. And you can't go down with somebody else holding your hand. I've tried it, you can't. So he had to feel his way all the way down the steep staircase, right down to the bottom. That's scary. Because if you've seen the pictures, I think it's on the book on Hezekiah by Brethren Harry Whittaker and George Booker. There's a picture on the front there of the Pool of Siloam. And you'll see exactly what I mean. It's a flight, steep flight of steps. And he had to find his way all the way down and then knelt at the water. Because the water's down then. You've got to get right down and wash away. And you'd look up. And you'd look up to the light right up there. And he could see. No wonder then that in the conversation which follows, he is absolutely convinced. I was blind, now I can see. I don't care about the theology of it. I don't care who it was. Not really. I was blind and now I can see. They called his parents. Well, yeah, this is our son. And we know he was born blind, but he can now see.
See the drama of the incident. I can imagine the whole of the city of Jerusalem would be absolutely agog. The rumour would go from person to person, and the whole city would be moved by the healing of this man who was born blind, who would be notorious. He would have been a beggar. His parents, you know, you despise, there's no welfare state. So get the drama of the incident. The man who was born blind could not see. And so the debate which ensues for the rest of the chapter is one of demonstration of conviction. Now, if only we had that conviction. If only we realised that before we were baptised, we were blind. And now we have the hope of the gospel and we can see. If only we had that total awareness of our blindness and now our sight. Of our ignorance and now our faith. We'd be telling everybody that we met. You see, we often say, nobody listens. Nobody preaches. If everybody in this room, every day of their life, spoke to a new person about the truth, what a powerful body of preachers we would be. So something that we can actually... The blind man who had been healed, he declared to everybody, I was blind and now I see. If we actually just talk to one person each day about our faith, just gently sharing our belief, what a transformation our lives would take. And how many others would come to a knowledge of the truth? You don't need high tech. It's useful, it's interesting. But fundamentally, all you need is a tongue. All you need is a hand outstretched to hold somebody else and say, have you heard? A little while ago, my next door but one neighbour's wife died. I went round to visit him and he said, I'm seriously ill as well, you know, and we've both had cancer and expect in a few weeks to be dead. When I do, I want you to do the funeral. Because he said, the funeral for my wife, I don't want anybody else to have a stranger lay them to rest. And just something that had said, some comment to him, over mowing the lawn, over about our beliefs, she'd picked up and then thought about. So we then spent the next day just talking about our beliefs. It's over the garden fence. It's washing the car. It's in the shopping queue where we show our Christianity and with the opportunity to share our faith. The blind man was so convinced that he consistently argued that he was now a seeing man. So much so that at the end of the chapter, the comment of Jesus now reinforces what I've just been saying. Because when you come to the end of chapter 9, there is a very interesting comment by the Master. And Jesus said, for judgment I am come into this world, that they which see not might see, and they which see might be made blind. Think about that. God sent his Son not to condemn the world but to save the world. But those who will not listen to him are blinded, and their blindness leads them to death. See, if we extend that, let's just for a minute think about this little figure. When we come to a knowledge of God, we turn round and face him. And the light of God's glory fills our lives and we can see where we're walking. Now, if we turn our back upon him, the light is behind us and we walk in our own shadow till we fall in the shadow of our own grave. Now, that's the judgment of God. the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, but you by your iniquities have separated yourselves from your God. The more you walk away from him, the further away he is. The more we turn around and face him and walk towards him, the more he can enter into our lives and illuminate our thoughts and our paths. The light of the body is the eye. If thine eye be evil, thy whole body is full of darkness. And what that means in spiritual terms is that our head is literally just dark, except for the light that enters through our eyes. Spiritually, our minds and our lives are full of evil and darkness. And we are only illuminated by that which we read and that which we hear of the Word of God. That's the Word of life, the Word of light and power, which can enter into our being and change us. So those who don't see, those who don't turn around and face God, those who don't walk in the light of his glory are condemned to eternal death. Those who think they see, but don't in reality. And that's where the comment to each of us is so pertinent. Because it's so easy to think that we have it all sewn up. It's what I call pigeonhole mentality. When I worked in school, we had an enormous pigeonhole rack. We had about 120 staff. And if I wanted to communicate with anybody, I'd write a memo and put it in their pigeonhole. And if I wanted a whole package of documentation, I'd do the packet and put it in their pigeonhole. That's all the information on that subject ready for them, in their pigeonhole. Now, we have a series of pigeonholes in our mind. One's marked creation. One's marked Bible prophecy. One's marked promises. One's marked, you know, ecclesial organisation. You know what I mean. We have a whole series of pigeonholes. And we've got it all wrapped up. And that's the doctrine and teaching on that item. When we want the answers, all we do is go to the pigeonhole in our mind, pull out the past, unwrap it. Here it is. Now, although it's safe, it's not very wise. Now, I'm not saying that we should re-examine every belief and every practice. I'm not saying that at all. But we should be a little more open than sometimes we are. Sometimes we think we see. Sometimes we think we have all the answers. And we're actually blind. We're blind to the needs of those who are about us. We're blind to those who are searching for sight. And that's what this second incident is all about. Is realizing the needs and responding to them. Now what we've looked at in the last yesterday and this morning are four characters. Four characters who are desperately different. We looked first of all at Nicodemus, what I believe was the president of the Jewish Sanhedrin, the most senior Jew in the land. We then thought about the woman at the well in Samaria who had had five husbands, and the man that she was now living with was not her husband. Wow. Despised and rejected. A woman of Samaria? What a contrast between Nicodemus and the woman of Samaria. And now this morning we've looked at again two totally different situations. A man despised and rejected in the pool of Bethesda, out at the rubbish tip, out where they washed the sheep, out where the smell and the gore existed. To the man who was blind from birth. And those four characters describe to us the way in which God, through his Son, saves men and women who are dying. So four different characters, four different situations, and four different bodies of teaching. The teaching is matched to the incident and arises out of the incident. So I hope then that from these two talks, you've now got four characters and the circumstance of their life in your minds as a word picture. And that we've been able to add without detracting from the message of the Gospel of John. Thank you.